You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our passage today are the last few verses of the Gospel of Matthew, with Jesus' big send-off and final commission to his disciples. In the opinion of many scholars, Matthew has the distinction of being the only gospel with a clear ending. Remember, for instance, Mark has three endings, each one getting more and more convoluted as later scribes tried to salvage what they thought was an unsatisfactory finale. And Matthew also offers some totally unique elements which most people think must be in all the Gospels, but are actually just Matthew. For instance, by the time our passage happens, Judas was dead, having returned the 30 pieces of silver and hanged himself. Pretty dramatic incident to be in only one gospel. Then, the remaining 11 disciples had instructions from Jesus that, after his resurrection, they should head up to Galilee to meet him. Now, this might be a surprise if you're reading Luke, because according to Luke, Jesus told the disciples to stay put in Jerusalem to prepare for Pentecost. Sorry, literalists. At any rate, note the reaction of Jesus' followers here. Some doubted or held back in the version that we're reading today. We don't know the identity and number of the some mentioned, but come on. Check it out. According to Matthew, even after seeing the resurrected Jesus, some of them doubted. Gotta love those disciples. They make us look great. Even so, Jesus commissions these same lunkheads to get out there and rustle up some disciples, offering some very clear instructions.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 through 20, the Message version.
Meanwhile, the 11 disciples were on their way to Galilee, headed for the mountain Jesus had set for their reunion. The moment they saw him, they worshiped him. Some, though, held back, not sure about worship, about risking themselves totally. Jesus, undeterred, went right ahead and gave his charge.
God authorized and commanded me to commission you. Go out and train everyone you meet, far and near, in this way of life, marking them by baptism in the threefold name, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Then instruct them in the practice of all I have commanded you. I'll be with you as you do this, day after day after day, right up to the end of the age.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
One day, Mullah Nasruddin ran across an agitated crowd gathered around the edge of a pond. A miserly old man had fallen in the water and was shouting, "Help! Help!" People were leaning over and saying, "Give me your hand, sir! Give me your hand!" But the old man refused their offers of rescue and kept wrestling in the water and shouting, "Help!" Finally, Nasruddin stepped forward and said, Let me handle this." He stretched out his hand toward the man and called out, "Sir, take my hand." Immediately, the old miser reached out and grabbed the mullah's hand and was hoisted out of the pond. Astonished, the crowd asked Nasruddin for the secret of his strategy. "It's very simple," he replied. "I know this miser wouldn't give anything to anyone. So instead of saying, 'Give me your hand,' I said, 'Take my hand.' And sure enough, he took it." Whether we like it or not, we all develop reputations for being givers or takers. People see who we are through our actions. That's one of the reasons why the Muslim mystics, the Sufis, who tell stories about Nasruddin, encourage the practice of secret charity, where a person benefits from your anonymous actions and doesn't have any chance to respond. Back in the 80s, when I first moved to Boston for grad school, I had to learn to navigate a highway hazard that I'd never encountered in Arizona: toll booths. Today, most toll roads use prepaid electronic debit devices or scan your license plate, but most of them still have at least one booth with a live human being. I'll always remember riding along with one of my classmates who made it a practice of pulling up to the booth, asking about the toll on the vehicle behind him, and then paying the toll for the total stranger behind us. Totally random act of kindness, generosity, call it what you will. But it brought him a kind of whimsical glee that you just can't get any other way. Back in the day, Harry Emerson Fosdick used to point out that the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea are the same water. And while the Sea of Galilee is beautiful and full of life, the Dead Sea is a foul-smelling, mineral-dense quagmire. Why? Because the Sea of Galilee has an outlet. It gathers its riches and then flows out into the Jordan River. But the Dead Sea has no outlet. It gets to keep. It's dead for a reason. And part of the reason our country is in such a toxic state right now is that people have warped the American dream into being all about accumulation for me, me, me. Our political and business elites are all about promoting scarcity and hoarding everything they can for themselves. The idea that life is only take, take, take without balancing it with a corresponding giving back is poisoning our culture. Instead of breathing in and breathing out, inhaling and exhaling, it's all about sucking the oxygen out of the room and leaving nothing for anyone else. When Jesus said, "The world will know that you are my followers if you love one another," he wasn't talking about some syrupy and saccharine kumbaya songfest. He was talking about action that people could see and experience. Jesus demonstrated it by being in relationship with people the religious folks deemed unworthy. People like Zacchaeus, the tax collector, a traitor, women in general. Shocking! He sought out the poor, the outcasts of society, the so-called sinners. Jesus loved people because they were fellow human beings. Outward appearances, labels, and cultural prejudices just didn't matter to him. In our passage today, Matthew tells us that when the post-resurrection Jesus gathers his followers in Galilee, he gives them specific instructions. "Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations." Now, I'll have to confess, I've always been aggravated at this passage because it's so often tossed around in a way that sounds downright coercive. "Get out there and make them be disciples." Sadly, the way this has been practiced through centuries of colonialism up to most conventional churches today is coerce them into believing a bunch of stuff we say they have to believe and teach them to hate the people we say to hate, and then God will love them. So first off, this nations bit is not the nation state we think of today, but the Greek word ethne, which means the Gentiles, the heathen, the unclean, the very people a good Jew would avoid to keep pure. And guess what? Matthew's gospel is written to a predominantly Jewish audience. So we have completely lost the original shock of such a statement. Jesus wants us to go to who? He wants us to do what? Listen again. Jesus is offering his followers some solid instructions. Listen for the verbs that are used. Train people in this way of life. Mark them with baptism. Instruct them how to practice. You notice what's missing? Believing stuff. It's just not there. Jesus is talking about action. Action that is contagious with people who the status quo says are undesirable or unworthy. Kathleen Norris writes, "You don't have to preach to people about the strength and joy that you found in your faith. Show them." And this is what continues to set the Fountains apart from most other churches. We are proponents of following Jesus in a way that says how we live is much more important than what we believe. And in that living, others take note of our actions and the values those actions reflect. Frederick Buechner writes, "As we move around the world and act with kindness, indifference, or hostility, we are setting the great spider web a tremble. The life I touch for good or ill will touch another life, and that in turn another, until who knows where the trembling stops or in what far place my touch will be felt." Just like the butterfly effect we talked about last week, our actions have reverberations which are felt way beyond our imagining, for good or ill. Remember the movie Pay It Forward? Critics panned it for what one said was blackmailing audiences into joining the Let's Be Nice movement. But what the cynics saw as a pie-in-the-sky cliché, audiences embraced as an illustration of a simple concept that would make the world a better place. You might remember that the assignment was for each student to come up with a way to change the world for the better.
That's me. That's me. And that's three people. And I'm going to help them. But it has to be something really big. Something they can't do by themselves. So I do it for them. Then they do it for three other people. That's nine. And I do three more.
That's 27, so I'm not really good at math, but it gets big really fast, you know? Articulation, please.
Yes.
I think it's a good idea.
Sean?
It's stupid.
Adam?
It's the honor system.
People blow off the honor system.
So what?
Just because you do.
Well, Trevor, the class seems to think that you've come up with an overly utopian idea. Look that word up in a minute.
Like a perfect world?
Mm-hmm.
So?
So, what put this idea in your head?
Because
everything sucks.
Right? Simple acts of generosity that aren't so simple. Why? Because it's not about unconditional, random acts of kindness. Trevor is talking about creating a culture where it's normal to give to others on the condition that they'll do the same for others. Rule number one, it has to be something that really helps people. Rule number two, it's something they can't do by themselves. And rule number three, I do it for them, they do it for three other people. Let's be real. If the idea of paying it forward is indeed some kind of pie-in-the-sky fantasy, then so is most of the stuff we lift up as core Christian values. Forgiveness, reconciliation, acceptance, love of enemy, peace. Shall I go on? If we don't participate in some small way in acting on these unnaturally suspended pie fantasies, they're bound to remain just that. Fantasies in our own lives and in the world. But if we take action, if we take our core skills and passions to put love first, who knows how the great spider web will be set a-tremble for good. And despite the urgency of responding to the outright evil that is being done in our names right now, what we're talking about here is a long-term investment. We have to change people one person at a time. When you teach, when you instruct, when you mark people, when you pay it forward, you often have to be satisfied knowing that you've done what you can, and the fruit of your efforts will only come sometime way down the line. Legend has it that Martin Luther once said, "Even if I knew that I would die tomorrow, I would still plant my apple tree." We make our investment. We pay it forward. And the Spirit takes it from there, at the right time and in the right place. The Fountains has been planting seeds of radical hospitality, praying well with others, and promoting critical thinking for many years now. And this very weekend marks the 10th anniversary of when 8 pious pastors took issue with that in a very public way. Their Fact or Fiction campaign was just another way of saying that we were being taken seriously and that they are afraid of Jesus' genuine teachings being let loose in the world. And in the ensuing decade, we've seen that what we've planted together as a community has taken root and continues to grow. Who knows what the Spirit has yet in store? Once upon a time, there was a woman who wanted peace in the world and peace in her heart and all sorts of good things. But she was very frustrated. The world seemed to be falling apart. She would read the news and get depressed. One day, she decided that going shopping would be a good distraction from it all. So she went to a local mall and picked a store at random. She walked in and was surprised to see Jesus behind the counter. She knew it was Jesus because he looked just like the pictures that she'd seen. She looked and looked at him and finally got up the nerve to ask, "Excuse me, but are you Jesus?" "I am. Do you work here?" "No, I own the store." "What do you sell?" "Oh, just about anything." "Anything?" "Yeah. What do you want?" "Well, I don't really know." "Well, then feel free to browse. Make a list and come back to the counter. We'll see what we can do." So she started to walk up and down the aisles and she made her list. Peace on earth, no more war, no hunger or poverty, no discrimination, an end to racism, no more violence in families, no more substance abuse, clean air. She was writing furiously. By the time she got back to the counter, she had a long list. Jesus took the list, skimmed it, and smiled. No problem. He then bent down behind the counter, picked out all sorts of things, stood up, and laid out a bunch of packets on the counter. "What are these?" she asked. "Seed packets. This is a catalog store." "You mean I don't get the finished product?" "Nope. You come in here, see what it looks like, and I give you the seeds. You plant them, nurture them, help them to grow, and someone else reaps the benefits." "Oh," she said, and left the store without buying anything. Friends, don't leave the store without buying anything. As a faith community, we've invested in planting and nurturing seeds of acceptance, tolerance, and encouraging the asking of tough questions. But this isn't a job for just the church. It's for each of us. So don't leave the store without buying anything. Take some seeds out there, or take just one. Plant it, nurture it, and when you do, you'll be making way for the Spirit to do its stuff. Be well. Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.